This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Kenya's opposition took to the streets outside the country's electoral board Tuesday to demand new officials to reorganize the rerun of the presidential poll, scheduled for October 26th. The opposition says it will boycott the poll if these personnel changes do not occur, while the ruling party rejects these threats.
That's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, Ethiopia's government says hundreds of people have been killed in clashes between ethnic Oromo and Somalis in the country's east. China stages military exercises in its first overseas military base in Djibouti, and Nigerian officials are cracking down on supporters of the Biafra separatist movement.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's opposition took to the streets outside the country's electoral board today to demand new officials to organize the rerun of the presidential poll scheduled for October 26th. The opposition says it will boycott the poll if these personnel changes do not occur. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig reports the ruling party rejects these threats.
The sounds of police firing tear gas and protesters in retreat filled the air outside Kenya's Electoral Commission Tuesday, as demonstrators attempted in several waves to get close to the building before police dispersed them. Opposition leader Raila Odinga has called for regular protests in order to pressure the Electoral Commission, or IEBC, officials to resign, including CEO Ezra Chiloba. Chiloba has refused.
IEBC cannot begin the process of ensuring an honest election as long as those responsible for the irregularities and illegalities are still lurking in its corridors. That is why we are today beginning this peaceful campaign to force them out by public pressure so that the process of fair elections can at last begin.
The Supreme Court recently gave its full explanation for why it nullified the August elections. Although it did not hold individuals responsible, the court blamed the commission, who it says refused a court order to open computer servers and to announce official results before all tally forms had been received during August 8th polls. 24-year-old Isaac Mbay is a student at the University of Nairobi, which is located across the street from the IEBC's headquarters. He says he is an opposition supporter, but he is not happy with these calls for protests.
Okay, there's some tear gas everywhere, and I can't manage. And this is political stuff. And as students, we are not happy about it because it's bringing misunderstanding everywhere and intolerance.
Prior to the demonstrations Tuesday, John Mbadi, chairman for Odinga's Orange Democratic Movement Party, announced President Uhuru Kenyatta had withdrawn the security detail for Odinga and his running mate, Kalonzo Musyoka.
We therefore give the states 24 hours to return our leaders' security or face mass action right at their doorstep. This is not negotiable.
Kenya's constitution dictates new polls must be held within 60 days of the ruling. The new date of October 26th falls just 5 days shy of that deadline. The ruling party has remained steadfast that this timeline must be followed and has rejected the idea of changing the commissioners. Many people are just hoping the politicians can sort out their issues before triggering a constitutional crisis. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Ethiopia's government says hundreds of people have been killed in clashes between ethnic Oromo and Somalis in the country's east. A spokesman says the government can't confirm the number of deaths and is trying to verify reports of the fighting on the border of the country's Oromo and Somalia regions. Negari Lencho says the conflict now is under control, although he says that some flare-ups could still happen. He said local leaders will be working with security forces to ensure that the Christian holiday this week remains peaceful. Tensions between the two groups flared up earlier this month. The government and some opposition leaders say tens of thousands of people have been displaced, but there has been no independent verification of those claims.
In Angola, João Lourenço has been sworn in as Angola's new president. He won the August 23rd election and replaces José Eduardo dos Santos, who had held the office since 1979. Lourenço is considered dos Santos' handpicked successor. The new Angolan leader fought against Portuguese colonial rule and in the country's long civil war that ended in 2002.
The World Health Organization reports 844,000 people in northeast Nigeria have been given one dose of oral cholera vaccine in an effort to prevent the fatal disease from spreading. The latest figures show nearly 4,000 suspected cases, including 54 deaths in the region. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The week-long campaign that ended Monday was centered in a camp for internally displaced people in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, as well as in several local government areas nearby. World Health Organization spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says hundreds of thousands of people above age one have received the oral vaccine and will be protected against cholera for up to 6 months. He notes the number of people at risk of getting cholera within an affected population decreases sharply as more people are vaccinated.
Cholera vaccines are used as a preventive tool in areas with few or no cases but are at a high risk of a spread of the disease, for example, if there are neighboring areas that are more affected. And obviously, I think there is an issue of access. There is a insecurity is a major constraint with the recent attacks on humanitarian staff.
The World Food Program suspended its operation in Borno State after aid workers were attacked in a camp for displaced people in Maiduguri at the end of August. The Boko Haram insurgency has killed more than 20,000 people and displaced more than 2 million since 2009. Jazarevich says the oral cholera vaccine is only one of the tools available to combat this disease. He says it should be combined with prevention activities such as informing communities about the need for good sanitation and hygiene and providing them with access to safe water. He says the World Health Organization is establishing cholera treatment centers as another important element in containing this outbreak. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Yesterday, 60 supporters of the Biafra separatist movement were imprisoned by court order in the southeastern Nigerian state of Abia. The order is part of a growing crackdown against the separatists by Nigerian officials. Chika Adua has more from Dakar.
This is what a typical IPOB rally sounds like. IPOB stands for the Indigenous People of Biafra. It's an organization calling for southeastern Nigeria to break away and form an independent country. In recent weeks, protests like this have become increasingly tense. An IPOB rally in Abia earlier this month left a police officer dead and a police station was nearly burned down. 60 people who took part in that rally have been arrested and charged with conspiracy, terrorism, attempted murder, and membership in an unlawful society. The governors of 5 southeastern states recently met and banned all IPOB activities, while the government has declared IPOB a terrorist organization, citing alleged offenses that included formation of a Biafra secret service and using weapons on Nigerian security forces. IPOB denies the charges.
We've never asked anyone to kill for us, neither have we killed anyone. We're not Boko Haram. We are not ISIS. We are just a non-violent freedom fighters. That's who we are. From inception, Nnamdi Kanu made it clear to the whole world that we're non-violent.
That's Emmanuel Kanu, the brother of Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of IPOB. Nnamdi Kanu's current whereabouts are unknown. The controversial leader was released in May after spending more than a year in detention facing charges of treason. For years, he ran an online radio program broadcasting from the United Kingdom. In his often violent rhetoric, he describes Nigeria as a zoo that must be destroyed. The government's only option, he recently suggested, is to give Biafra its freedom.
Our promise is very simple. If they fail to give us Biafra, Somalia will look like a paradise compared to what will happen to that zoo.
Southeastern Nigeria is home of the Igbos, one of Nigeria's largest ethnic groups. Many Igbos say the predominantly Muslim Hausa Fulani people of northern Nigeria dominate the federal government and marginalize the largely Christian Igbos. An attempt to carve an independent Biafra out of the southeast in 1967 triggered a civil war that killed nearly 1 million people. Igwe Christopher Ejiofor is a traditional Igbo king who fought on the Biafran side in that war. He says IPOP has legitimate grievances, but that its approach is wrong.
Nnamdi Kanu expressed something that is not stamped and approved by the Igbo people as a whole. In political terms, no governor, there are no elders, no statesmen, no higher profile Igbo politicians have said that they are in support of Nnamdi Kanu or that they want Biafra to be declared.
Many Igbos say they do not want to repeat history, but many Igbos have condemned the government's deployment of troops in the southeast this month. And as Nigeria's October 1st Independence Day gets closer, ethnic and political tensions remain worrisomely high. Chika Odua in Dakar for VOA News.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Kenya, the opposition says it will boycott the poll if personnel changes are not made to the electoral board. According to Ethiopia's government, hundreds of people have been killed in clashes between ethnic Oromo and Somalis in the eastern part of the country. And Nigerian officials are cracking down on supporters of the Biafra separatist movement. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Libya's General Khalifa Haftar is in Rome today, where he's meeting with Italian officials. The visit is said to be a radical departure for Italy, which had previously shunned Haftar. Italian officials have considered him a major obstacle to stability in Libya and the region because he refuses to recognize the UN-backed government of national accord. In addition, Amnesty International and similar groups have accused Haftar of human rights abuses. Reporter Josephine McKenna is in Rome covering the latest developments. She spoke with me about the significance of General Haftar's visit to Italy.
Well, General Khalifa Haftar, who controls nearly half of Libya from his base in the east of the country, arrived in Rome late Tuesday, and he is having secret meetings with two Italian ministers, the Minister for Defense, Roberto Pinotti, and the Minister for the Interior, Marco Minniti. Now, Haftar faced criticism from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. There are concerns about his army, his militias, and what they may be doing in terms of human rights in Libya. But he's become a linchpin for European officials who want to slow the flow of migration from Libya to Europe.
The talks that are occurring today with two of Italy's ministers, what do you think will come out of these talks?
It's clear from what we know about the relations between Italy and Libya that these talks are very much focused on strengthening security in Libya and stopping the flow of migration, illegal migrants coming across the Mediterranean from Libya to Europe. We've already seen a dramatic slowdown. the number of migrants arriving has fallen more than 20% recently, and we've had around 100,000 arrivals since the beginning of the year. That's much lower compared to the same period last year, where we had 131,000. This strategy appears to be working, but the Italian officials and the European officials in other countries are relying on this agreement, this alliance, this cooperation with Haftar and others in Libya to keep this in place, to slow down the flow of migrants and ensure that this doesn't become a political issue for Italian leaders and others in other European countries.
What exactly is the strategy that General Haftar is using to stop the flow of migrants, or rather slow down the flow of migrants?
Well, it's clear that the Italian government cannot just rely on the Tripoli administration. It has to build agreements with Haftar, who controls nearly half of Libya from his base in the east, in order to keep this situation under control. We've already seen that the issue of migration was an important issue in the recent German election. The Italian government is going to be facing an election early next year. The Italian political parties here are very concerned about migration as an issue, and that is why the Italian government in particular is working so hard to build agreements with Haftar and others in Libya to slow this flow of migrants that we saw earlier this year. Recently, we've seen a dramatic fall. The number in August fell to around 3,900 arrivals, and that was the lowest rate of migrant arrivals we've seen in Italy this year. So that strategy appears to be working, but the Italians are very concerned as we face an election in Italy in early 2018.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
One month after opening its first overseas military base in Djibouti, China has staged military exercises there. AFP reports state television has shown armored vehicles and dozens of soldiers conducting live fire operations in the desert in temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius. The Chinese military personnel are expected to support UN peacekeeping operations, evacuate Chinese nationals, and provide naval escorts.
The policies of rich nations can have a profound effect on poor nations. And during the third week of the UN General Assembly session in New York, the Center for Global Development is presenting its annual Commitment to Development Index. The report ranks 27 of the world's richest countries on policies that affect the more than 5 billion people living in poorer nations. VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed its two co-authors, Ian Mitchell and Anita Capelli. They began the conversation by explaining what the Commitment to Development Index is and how it differs from studies that give development advice to poor countries.
What our index does is focus on the richer countries and asks what they do for poorer countries. We look at seven areas of policy that really matter to development, for example, aid, but also trade and environment. And then we rank those rich countries on how much policy effort they put into those different areas.
Who are the great stars in this report and who could use some real help?
This year it's Denmark, which leads the way, followed by Sweden and Finland.
We see the US very much near the bottom of the league. We see East European countries who are relatively new to development in the middle of the table, and the Scandinavian countries are the leaders, but other countries like Germany and France are moving and improving their performance over time.
Why is it important to rate these places? Are you trying to embarrass them?
The idea is to let these rich countries learn from each other on policy. So one of the nice things in the index is that even some of the countries that have finished in the bottom half are still very strong on certain parts of the index. So a nice example is the Slovak Republic. They don't give a lot of money on aid, but they do score extremely well on the environment component. Their environmental policies are doing a lot for the developing world. Some of the things that we consider are the taxation level on petrol and gas in the country, the amount of greenhouse gas emissions per person, how successful the country has been in reducing greenhouse gases. And in the case of the Slovak Republic, they score very well across all of those indicators and are therefore making an important contribution globally.
Why is that a development issue for Africa or these other places if the Slovak Republic is keeping its own air and water clean?
If Slovak Republic does more for global environment, it's going to help us all, no matter where we live.
Exactly. We reward countries that are contributing positively to these things, which you might call global public goods, things that we all collectively share, and the environment is a perfect example of that.
Are there other examples?
The other important examples are on research and development. So this is in the technology component of the index. We think that those insights created and the science discovered are usable by every country. So the more countries are contributing to research and development that can be used everywhere, then the more credit we give them.
Could you speak specifically about this report and its relevance to African and African issues?
I think we can take the example of migration, where we look at which countries, for instance, enable international students, so it could be African students, to actually come to their countries and learn valuable skills, which then they can apply when they go back to their countries of origin.
We're looking for policies that integrate migrants well into local communities and local economies. We're looking at overseas students and where they come from, whether your overseas students are representative around the globe or whether the countries are only really accepting migrants from other rich countries in high-skilled areas.
Who do you give a good grade to for that?
So Germany has been very good at helping migrants in the last few years. It's also Canada and New Zealand.
What are some of the other categories in a nutshell?
Trade is another important one. Almost no country has developed without also learning how to trade with other countries. And rich countries have a big bearing on developing countries' ability to trade through their trade policy, whether they charge tariffs on developing country exports, whether they subsidise agriculture, and whether there's red tape. Trying to export to a rich country, is it administratively straightforward? Are there a number of hurdles that it's difficult for you to overcome? So we assess that systematically, given the importance of trade and the discussion about increasing trade barriers.
Any parting comments you have about the overall conclusions or even the feeling you get from the report? Has the richer nations become more development friendly, or are people sort of closing ranks and shutting down?
I think the overall progress is relatively limited for the 27 countries. There's certainly not any sign of dramatic improvement in those countries' efforts, which calls into question the pace at which the Sustainable Development Goals would be achieved.
What we learn every year is that even the best countries can learn from other countries, and I think we can all do better.
Ian Mitchell and Anita Capelli are the co-authors of this year's Commitment to Development Index. They spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips at the United Nations in New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, fresh off a three-nation Africa visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Tanzania. Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered, reporting on democracy in Africa. On the road with Shaka, on the next, Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 1730 UTC right here on VOA.